Okay, I'm going to bring the House and Committee on Environment and Energy to order. I'm going to be passing the gavel to Vice Chair Power to hold a public hearing on House Bill 2722 in a moment. Before that, I wanted to make an announcement to folks that may have been watching the development of the joint meeting of this committee and the Senate Committee on Natural Resources and the Environment that will occur on Tuesday evenings for the month of March. They will be held in at 5:30 p.m. in Hearing Room A, and we'll be talking about issues that are component pieces to carbon pricing systems that Oregon might use in creating its own system for climate change response. Tomorrow night is a focus on the impacts to business if we choose to do nothing about climate change. So we'll be looking at two reports. One is the E2 report, and the other is the Risky Business report. Both of them attempt, from an economic point of view, to calculate the impacts of climate change on our economy in the state. And these meetings are open to everyone. They're, of course, colleagues on the committee here. They're open to all of us, and I hope that some of you will attend. We will be needing to be sensitive to quorum issues because it is a posted meeting. It's optional, but to the extent possible, I think the coming schedule is going to be interesting. It is going to be informative from the point of view of providing information that we haven't seen in any committee meeting yet. So I would urge you to come if you have a chance. We'll work out quorum issues ahead of time.
So, Mr. Chair, just confirm this is a work group, not a public hearing of the policy committee. Is that right?
Yes. It's run as an optional work group.
I guess my question would be, if it ultimately might result in a piece of legislation, why would we not want to make it an official work of the policy committees that within the House and the Senate?
That's a good question, and we've considered it closely, and the coordination between the Speaker's office, the President's office, the Senate committee, and our committee is sufficiently complex to need it to be an informational meeting only. To the extent that we've reached conclusions, those can come back forward into a regular hearing on our regular schedule sometime in April. Okay. And with that, I'll hand it over to Vice Chair Power, and I'll return as soon as I can.
Mm-hmm. All right, and with that, I will should I gavel beforehand or after? Okay. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2722 with Representative Beil joining us to testify. I think you're going to do
both,
right? Okay. How do you want me to hand it?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come together today to talk to you. And my name is Susan McClain from House District 29, and to talk about House Bill 2722. And I want to just let you know that basically this is dealing with homeowner associations and condos and really talking about trying to be more water conservation-minded. And just as a background for some of you who were here in 2016, basically, I was able to get together with Senator Hansel, and we partnered up on a similar bill, and it was a bill which called Senate Bill 1529. And this prohibited HOAs from fining members from not watering their lawns during a declared drought. And that took us halfway down the road of where we wanted to go as far as trying every single possible way to figure out how to conserve our very important type of resource, such as water. And we worked with a work group that was from the HOAs, and I worked with folks like now Representative Vile, Barbara Kuntz, and Gene Grant, who also his testimony is on OLIS, and he was a member of the condominium and HOA working group, and he has now since retired and is off having adventures around the world. But the background is that we want to make sure that we're conserving water not just during the time of drought, but that we are actually conserving water the best we can in every way that we can, because water is such an essential resource that we need in almost everything we do, whether it be economics on agricultural levels or whether it be economics for high tech or whether it be lakes and making sure that we have rivers and streams that are friendly to fish. But there are many reasons why we want to conserve water. One of the small jurisdictions in my area, Yam Hill, actually in 2015 was within 17 days of not having any municipal water for their residents. And so it's extremely important for us to conserve water on all levels. What this bill does is it gives an alternative way for homeowner associations and condominium associations to maintain their environment that they prefer in their community, but also practice proactive water conservation. It expressly allows them to look at old landscaping requirements, and with their association membership approval, they will be able to try some of these new water, low water type of landscapes if they choose to do so. Water conservation and using water efficiently and avoiding waste is essential to ensure that we have adequate water today and in the future. Water is a finite resource, and it supplies us on this earth with some very important pieces, including keeping us alive for the amount of water that we also need to be drinking daily if we want to be healthy. I think it's extremely important for you to know that the condominium and the HOA Association has reviewed this. They worked on it. They worked on the legal language. We had it okayed through our legal staff, and you'll hear a little bit more about that from Representative Vile. So thank you very much for the opportunity, and I encourage you to pass House Bill 2722.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Power, members of the committee. I'm Rich Vile, a state representative from House District 26, that's Shoals-Sherwood area. I've been a member of the Condominium Working Group for about the last 35 years since my graduation from law school, and have worked in many sessions here before the legislature on issues regarding homeowner associations and condominiums. Just by way of putting this in context, we now have approximately 12,000 homeowner associations in Oregon. Many of our residents are residing in homeowner associations, and virtually all new housing that is built today is contained in some kind of a homeowners association, whether it's a vertical condominium type association or a planned community, which is a subdivision that contains covenants designed to protect the interests of the owners. Most of those projects were done before the last 10 years, although there has been an acceleration. In many of those projects, the declaration, that set of covenants that tells folks what their rights and liabilities are, contains in the very declaration itself a requirement to water your yard. And so if someone wants to change that declaration, and there's a 75% vote required to change the declaration, it may be impossible for the board of directors to institute a program like that that Representative McLean just described to us. We have worked extensively with the management companies, the lawyers, the boards of directors for homeowners associations over the last several years, and we believe this bill accurately reflects the desire of those homeowner associations to have more flexibility. It's an unusual thing to override the private contracts that were entered into by folks when they bought their property and bought pursuant to a recorded set of CC&Rs. But we have vetted the constitutionality of this, and we believe that this represents the best solution to allow homeowners associations to impose upon the owners a more balanced and a set of covenants that is more reflective of our modern desire to be conservationist when it comes to water. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you. What is Xeriscape? Line 39, page 4.
Vice Chair Power, Representative Barnhart. Xeriscape is a term that has kind of become popular among the landscaping community that is an attempt to install landscaping that requires no unnatural watering. So Xeriscape would be different in every climate. In Oregon, that would be a certain type of plant that does not require watering other than our natural rainfall to remain healthy.
Okay. Could I ask a different question? Thank you. I understand there's a whole lot of these governing documents that require a certain amount, certain kind of landscaping, and that the design committees are very jealous about protecting all of that. If I understand this bill correctly, what it does essentially is say, no, no, you can't do that in the various conditions that are stated on page 4. But instead, you have to be able to do other things. And I think it also says that the homeowners association can require that a landscape owner, condominium owners, install vegetation that doesn't need water. Did I understand that correctly?
Vice Chair Power, Representative Barnhart, here's what it does. For those situations that have a set of CC&Rs that require a certain level of landscape to be maintained, it allows the Homeowners Association to override that in times of drought without having to take any votes. This is important because you may have one owner that wants to conserve water. You may have another owner that doesn't like brown lawns and is about to sue the board of directors because they haven't enforced what's in the CC&Rs. This gives the board of directors cover to make sure that in those situations of drought. It also gives the boards of directors the ability to change those requirements without having to go out and get a vote. So you can get changes to the CC&Rs without having to go get the 75% vote for the future, including installation of Xeriscaping.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions?
Out of curiosity, a big drought strikes, and somebody at the in the association is trying to keep not their grass green, but their trees from dying. So they've very carefully put small drip systems of water in. Does this give the folks the power to prevent even that from happening?
I'm going to try and answer that, and then Representative Vial will correct me if necessary. He's the lawyer, and I'm just the general citizen. But when we passed the bill, Mr. Hansel and I, and Senator Hansel and I, before, it does allow during a drought to have a condition where it's a drought. And so that bill said, basically, we're not going to tell you can't water your lawn. We're just telling you don't have to water it to a certain level of greenness, or you don't have to put in, X amount of water on your lawn or your trees. And so that is already in place in the rule that we passed last time in 2016. What this does is go one step further and allow that board to be proactive in conservation and actually allow and actually go forward with some more pro-conservation activity. And right now they had to reach a 75% actual vote from their membership to do anything. And so this gives a little bit more power to their leadership to allow them still to have the folks that they actually decide to have on their board have a little bit more opportunity to be conservation-minded.
I'm not sure.
Vice Chair Power, Representative Bentz, the direct answer to your question is in no case would the bill cause an association to require that trees not be watered. That would be up to the board. The board may decide that in a severe enough situation, you can water certain things but not other things, but the bill itself would not set the standard by which that happens. It would be up to the board of directors.
all of them. So I think the question was, could the board say, no, you can't water your trees if they so voted?
If it were one of those designated periods where there was a declared drought by a municipality or other governmental agency that had authority over that particular geography, it is possible that the board could say, nobody's watering anything.
They could do that now.
Vice Chair Power, Representative Pence, they probably couldn't do it now to answer Representative McLean's question if in the declaration there was a requirement to keep things watered.
Okay.
So this would make that change.
Right.
Any further questions? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. It's interesting how, you know, we have circumstances like the drought we had a couple of years ago that lead to legislation like this and so forth. I understand the purpose, but I almost wonder if in the next session we might not have you or other folks up here asking for sandbag exemptions due to the weather that we've had, this environment where folks may not appreciate the surface drainage that exists in their HOA and they want to protect their life and property and they don't feel like they have the wherewithal to do that. But that aside, I wonder if it's a little too broad, I guess, and I only ask the question, it pertains to what you have in here. This can happen if a declaration by the governor that severe continuing drought exists or is likely to occur, or the same thing with Water Resources Commission, likely to occur. And I ask that because we had testimony last week regarding climate change, and we had a very intelligent gal in here from OSU that was basically made the point that, you know, the impacts, the meteorological impacts due to climate change are baked in, the cake's baked. Nothing we can do to amend that or get out from underneath it. And drought or persistent droughts and less rainfall is one of those meteorological effects that we should anticipate and prepare for. So I just wanted to get back to your comment about a proactive board. I want to make sure that a board, this doesn't give too much a latitude for a proactive board to go ahead based on the testimony we heard last week to go ahead and make that determination now. And I don't think that's what you're intending.
It's not.
But I wonder if we shouldn't just go, I'm just throwing out a suggestion, get back to just leave it at a drought declaration by a governor or by a agency or water resources board rather than likely to occur. I think it maybe is a little bit of a gray area, but maybe I'm just splitting hairs there. So,
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I think you make a very good point. And just to make sure that the record is clear, the group I represent has folks falling on both sides of this question. There's folks that are not real happy about this idea. I'm certainly inclined to work with Representative McLean, see if we can't arrive at language. However, I will say that in spite of the fact that I typically don't want to mess with boards or don't want to mess with recorded CC&Rs, I do understand the need for the drought declaration kind of stuff. And, you know, even relative to Representative Bence's question, if you've got a yard with a whole bunch of black cottonwood trees that are just sucking water out of the ground, it may be appropriate for the board to say, no, let's let those suckers die and let's put something in that doesn't use as much water. So there is a balance, and the commitment I would make is to work with Representative McLean to make sure that we got something that achieved the objectives that her folks were after and that still protected the association.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does sections 10 through 13 do? They don't look like they're part of the same thing, but maybe they are, and I just don't understand them.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, this could take a long time, but a brief statement is there are actually three types of homeowner associations in Oregon. This goes through and helps us understand the applicability to all three types. The bottom line is there's a couple of types that wouldn't be affected at all because they weren't originally affected by the homeowner association law, and so they would still have all of the flexibility that they had even before this bill. They were typically the smaller HOAs that weren't impacted by the 1981 effective 82 Planned Community Act.
Okay. Now, if I could follow up. Section 11 purports to allow the establishment of a homeowners association.
Yes.
And I'm in a Class 1 or Class 2 plan community created before January 1st, 2002. Is that a cleanup section, or is that really part of what you were working on?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is a cleanup section that relates back to now a 30-year-old law that hasn't ever given these little ones the opportunity to get themselves organized. And it is something that is very helpful to these. When you have a question like water, and you've got CC&Rs, and they don't have any way to make decisions among themselves, this gives them that ability.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay.
Thank you. And then you wanted to stay.
I don't think we have anybody else signed up from public testimony. Is there anybody who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. All right. Do I need to gavel and close it? All right. Then I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2722 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2111. Representative Vile and then Bravis on behalf of Representative Greenlick is here as well, I think, to testify, hopefully. Yes. Okay. Sure. Why don't you
Yeah, come on. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is another HOA-related bill. This essentially arises out of the need by the folks that are installing solar systems and solar panels on homes that are located in planned communities to make sure that the planned community can't simply deny the ability for someone to put a set of solar panels on their roof. It's the same thing as we saw years ago with antennas for collection of different types of signals. It's the idea that you can regulate where and how they might attach them so long as they have access to the sun, but you can't simply deny the opportunity for a homeowner to use the sun as part of their utility collection. And again, the Condominium and Homeowner Association Working Group has looked at this. We're supportive. The bill does contain specific language that allows the association to still determine within reason, as long as they can collect the sun, where it goes, what it looks like, how it gets installed, so that any common elements are not impacted that would make it more expensive for the rest of the owners.
Yes, thank you, Chair, Vice Chair Power, and Vice Chair Johnson. For the record, I'm Travis Mavison, Legislative Assistant to Representative Greenlick. He apologizes he couldn't be here today. He is currently in the Healthcare Committee. I'm chairing that one right now. But I'm here to speak on 2111, and like Representative Vile did discuss, this simply puts into statute that one homeowners association or planned community can't simply deny the ability to use solar panels. It doesn't discuss, though, you know, whether it's the design, the model, the aesthetic characteristics. It doesn't, it lets that still be up to the homeowners association. So they're still within reasonable guidelines of working with people who would like to use solar panels. Representative Greenlick believes this is really a strong bill, and it's good for the public interest as more people become more invested into using alternative energy and resources to live their lives. So thank you very much for letting me testify.
Very good. Any questions from the committee? Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you. And thank you, Representative and staff. Homeowners Association will still be able to dictate where they are on the roof. So I'm just thinking there's certain locations that you want these solar panels on roofs to maximize the benefit of the sun. That might not be in the best interest of the Homeowners Association. And so they would still be able to you know, let's say they only want them on the back sides of the roofs, right? But
north that, side,
which is the north side. Thanks, Representative. which you know could cause issues. Have you thought about that? What?
Chair Helm, Representative Brocksmith, we did not participate, unfortunately, in the drafting of this one. And I will confess to you that I think there are probably things here that haven't yet been completely thought out. We are not opposed to the idea that the HOA can't prohibit it. The law already contains specific allowance for the HOA to determine design, placement, et cetera. Now, obviously, it doesn't make a lot of sense for a bill to say you can't prohibit it and then for the association to say, all right, we'll let you have it, but it can only be on the north side where there is never any sun. But that is, I'm sure, the kind of thing that probably will have to get worked either in subsequent legislation or perhaps even at the rulemaking level in particular homeowner associations. If a homeowner association tries to adopt a rule that that says you can only put them on the north side, I suspect that Representative Greenlick would be back in front of us with a bill to try and fix that.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I think I was a co-sponsor of a bill in the last session or the session before on this topic. I actually like this bill better than the one that Representative Greenlick and I came up with last time. The question I was going to ask, and then I realized I've answered it for myself, is that it says that the you can't prohibit the owner of the roof or other exterior portion of a building from installing solar panels. And in most condominiums that are in a single building, the exterior and the roof are common property, and therefore they wouldn't be subject to this provision. On the other hand, if it's a detached house and you're in a planned unit development with a homeowners association, whatever those are called now, then it would be applied because the roof and the walls belong to the person who owns the property. So it looks to me, at least, as though this probably works. And I suspect you're right. The rule about the north side probably doesn't pass the laugh test.
Representative Helm, Representative Barnhart, Chair Helm, Representative Barnhart, I will tell you that it's often misunderstood. There are really two types of homeowner associations in Oregon: condominiums, which the roof would be common property,
right,
unless the HOA decided nobody's putting a solar panel up there, and planned communities, which is the other type, right, where the individual owns their lot, has control over their home. But even there, it's important to note that all sorts of declarations exist,
yes,
that cover how you treat the exterior of your home in a planned community.
Right.
The laugh test may be something that is true, but I have seen many that tried to get by the laugh test, and we'll just have to see how this one goes.
Yeah, let me, if I could, just follow up on that quickly. We're in the process of building a house in one of those second kinds you were describing, and we had a conversation with the design committee on exactly this topic, and we won the argument, but I don't know whether, in fact, legally, we could have forced them to allow us to put solar panels on the roof. I think this is a good bill.
Thank you.
Representative Bennis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And indeed, I do remember this from previous discussions. And of course, the issue always is what type of activity is it that we would allow to upset contractual obligations or previous agreements? And so I am just curious why those bringing the bill this time believe that solar panels rise to a level that would allow contractual obligations to be upset. And what I'm really asking is a question that comes up from a previous situation that we heard, I think, in this committee, where someone wanted to hang all of their wash out across the, I can't remember if it's Black Butte or some river, wherever it was someplace, and that was so they would not have to use their dryer because they found that to be inconsistent with their desire to not burn up electricity. And so my obvious question is, solar panels, yes, the laundry, no? I mean, that's the question.
I think when kind of drafting this bill, when speaking to Representative Greenlick about it, I think a lot of it comes from the idea that the solar panels have become a very successful way of contracting energy. to use in good of the public interest. And so that's one of the reasons why we drafted it that way. I'm unfamiliar with the washing or hanging out your clothes to dry. So I don't really think I could speak on all the reasons why one that might be inappropriate in a planned community at this point.
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz. Oh, yeah. You're dead right. There is no practical difference other than one has a whole lot stronger lobby than the other, and we're looking at a situation where we've got an accepted means of alternate energy that has gotten some real traction. But in fact, your legal analysis is absolutely correct.
Follow up. And, Mr. Chair, I was hoping for something that would prevent the storm of people upon this building asking to hang their laundry out in these locations. That disturbs me. So, but I haven't gotten much help.
Chair Helm, Representative Bent, sorry. Yeah.
We all have our priority bill.
Any further questions are important than
your own, John. Your point about the activist groups, I can imagine that the wind turbine lobby will be on their way down here soon as well, right? In my neck of the woods, anyway.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, it is interesting because this whole solar panel thing, years ago, you couldn't put anything except shakes on most roofs, right? Now, okay, we can put a solar panel on a roof. The wind turbine is coming, and I can tell you that that lobby is getting stronger every day. So Representative Bentz's concern is not without some merit.
My question is, Rep. Boyle, so this would, the HOA can't prohibit an owner from installing under the proper circumstances, but they aren't necessarily required to approve a request, right? There still is that process of the application, looking over what the proposal is, and the HOA or the owners thereof would still have that ultimate authority, correct, if in fact they can't get to an understanding for a practical solution.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, absolutely, and I think that within the framework of this specific bill, there probably are still going to be questions that may not be easily resolved in that process.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions?
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good. Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2111 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2134. And I'll ask Varner Seaman, Elizabeth Howe, and Ryan Fisher to come forward.
Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Fisher. I'm here today on behalf of the Community Action Partnership of Oregon. The Community Action Partnership of Oregon represents the Community Action Network, which covers all 36 counties in Oregon with 18 agencies. The majority of those are 501c3 nonprofits, and they each have local boards, meaning that each of them designs their own program to serve low-income Oregonians. One of the things, though, that they all have in common is that they all provide emergency housing assistance and they all provide emergency energy bill payment assistance. And we're here today to talk about the Oregon Energy Assistance Program, which is one of the energy assistance programs that the community action agencies administer in partnership with the investor-owned utilities. The energy assistance is an extremely important part of the work that community action agencies do. We know that every kid does better in school when they have a safe place to call home. We know that families that don't have to choose between paying rent or buying food or medicine are going to be more successful. And energy bills are really a part of housing stability. I've been working on housing issues for a number of years now. When I first started, it was very difficult to get people to listen to some some of those issues that we were working on. Now, you know, folks are calling us and saying, how do we work on this issue? Because I'm hearing about it from my constituents. So this is a very important bill. I'm going to let some of the utilities discuss what it does technically. But I just want to say that, you know, we've worked in partnership on this concept. This is our fourth session now, I believe, that we've worked on this issue together. And it's a great example of everybody coming together for a common purpose.
Ryan, thanks. I understand that you need to leave by 3:45. So
I've got somebody covering that, so I can be available.
Oh, okay. Well, let's hear from the rest of the panel, and then I understand there's also an amendment that you would like to discuss as well.
Yes.
Okay.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman, representing Portland General Electric. I'm here today in support of 2134, in particular the Dash 3 amendment that we'll talk about in a little bit. So the history of this program is that going back for a couple of decades, there has been for PGE and PacifiCorp customers a level of funding for bill payment assistance for the Oregon Energy Assistance Program, or OEAP. Over the years, that number was increased up to a base level of funding of $15 million that the Public Utility Commission goes through a rate-setting process and splits up the collection of those funds between the customers of PGE and Pacific Power. Going back to 2009, when we were in the depths of the financial 2011. Pardon me. 2011, when we were in the depths of the financial crisis, Representative McLean and Representative Koch-Tech together came forward and supported a supplement of $5 million on top of the base, $15 million. That was passed in 2011. As a two-year short-term supplement to the OEAP program. That $5 million supplement was extended in 2013 and 2015. Now that we're in 2017 and we're looking at coming back for another two-year short-term extension to that, parties, the three folks in front of you, as well as the Citizens Utility Board, or CUB, had some conversation, and we said, well, maybe what we ought to acknowledge is that the need for assistance is not something that we're growing our way out of yet. Hopefully over the long term we can, but what we see is that the need for people to have bill payment assistance pretty significantly outpaces the available funds even with this bill. What the Dash 3 amendment would do is change the base level of funding from $15 million to $20 million and have that be the base level of annual funding split up between the two utilities on a going forward basis. So instead of having $15 million with a $5 million supplement, yielding $20 million, we would simply have $20 million paid for between the customers of the two utilities to go to the community action agencies to administer for low-income bill payment assistance. We believe that from a customer perspective, there are two ways we can pay for people who don't have the ability to pay their bills. One is people can pay their bill with assistance through some sort of a program, this or federal money with the LIHEAP program, or we can have folks not pay their bills. That can be regarded as bad debt, and then we try to collect that in some other manner. We think that this is more efficient than having people having their power shut off. We think it's better for customers to have some assistance that's available to them, and that's why we support this program. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me, my name is Elizabeth Howe. I'm here representing Pacific Power. I guess I'll address the Dash 3 amendment. We are supportive of the bill and the Dash 3 amendment. We realized in looking back over how funds have been collected in this program that the Public Utility Commission didn't have the ability to change the rate if somehow we got too far off of the 15 or the 20 million. So this bill would give them the authority to change the rate so that if it goes over or under, they have the ability to get as close to 20 million as possible. And that's at their discretion for when they would make that change. And I believe it's a Dash 3. Did I say that? So we're supportive of that amendment. This program has been successful for our customers. As you know, Pacific Power is a predominantly rural utility, and our areas have had more trouble recovering from the economic recession. So there's definitely need in our communities, and we think this is a good way to go about helping our customers. So thank you for your time. We're happy to take questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan, there's a lot more in this bill. This dash three, this is like 10 or 12 pages. Yeah. Can you just walk us through some of this?
Chair
this
Helm.
Bill is really simple, but yeah. This thing suddenly just froze.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. You know, it's funny, the first iteration that we had was extremely short. The second iteration, LC took the opportunity to make a lot of their what they call template changes. And so most of what you see in that bill are these changes. I don't have the amendment in front of me, but really I think it's on page 4 is kind of the core of that. Where you see that bulk of bold type, that's really essentially what the bill is doing. The rest is all what they would refer to as cleanup or template changes. This statute is, I think, was written in the late 90s, as I understand it, and so they've had many formatting changes since then.
Thank you.
Follow up.
And for either of our IOU folks, as we talk about bills and talk about our energy bills and low-income folks and their inability to, or difficulty in making, especially in a winter like this, I'm sure, when we've had the heater's been on a bunch, but what impact is net metering having on cost shifts to serve some of our population? Because obviously there's more of that, I think, happening now, probably within PGE's jurisdiction more so than Pacific Corp's, I'm guessing, in Oregon anyway. But is that a concern going forward? Is that something we should be paying attention to as we talk about burdens and cost shifts from those that can to those that cannot?
Sure.
Chair Helm, Representative Johnson, Vice Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Let me give a little background on that. So with net metering, which topical given that we were just talking about solar a moment ago, the way that net metering works is that customers who put utility customers can put solar panels on their property, both residential, commercial, and industrial customers can all do that, and there's a cap that a facility cannot be larger than 2 megawatts in nameplate size. We buy that power at retail rate less some adjustments. I think public purpose charge and some other things are not considered in that retail rate. So we pay about 11.3 cents for the power. There is a concern that net metering based on retail rate isn't necessarily the best way to compensate folks for having solar on their rooftop. And there is a concern, and this is part of a national policy conversation that's taking place around whether net metering, so essentially over time, utility rates have a tendency to move upwards, and the price of solar panel is moving on a pretty downward trajectory. And so there's some concern that as you've got some delta there, that net metering becomes an overly rich payment for what the resource is worth. There is a docket taking place at the Public Utility Commission right now called the Value of Solar Docket, where what the commission is endeavoring to do, and this is a pretty lengthy docket, it's been going on, I believe, a year and a half. We anticipate it'll take another year, that in that Value of Solar Docket, the PUC is going to look at what is the locational benefit, what is the avoided transmission or distribution investment that needs to be made because of solar bringing a benefit to the system, and they're going to look at what is the appropriate valuation for solar. I believe the PUC, in an earlier report to the legislature last year, they do a, I think PUC does a regular report that this committee gets. The PUC in that report indicated that on a going forward basis, they would like to move from net metering to a value of solar, and PGE supports that. We think that net metering is a little bit of a blunt instrument. It worked in an earlier time, but as we advance and we have more solar penetration, there does become some concern about getting that valuation right. We think that the value of solar process, and this is something that's happened across the country, it's part of an adjudicated process that PUC is taking on. We think it's an appropriate place to be looking at what the valuation for solar should be going forward.
Further questions, Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, Barbara, this is just for, you already said this, but I just want to make it clearer. But when we discussed this, the 2134 bill some years ago, there was a pretty clear statement that the amount that the utility saved by virtue of not having to go through the shutting it off, ultimately turning it back on, and all the stuff in between, and all litigation, what all. And that was a pretty easy case to make at the $10 million. It was easy to make at the $15 million. and now we find ourselves at the $20 million. At what point will you not be able to make that case?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, I don't know. I think that the economic, let me endeavor to try to address that, though. The basic economic argument on this, as I understand it, is that where you have people who are unable to pay, their power is shut off, there's that disruption for those folks, there's that disruption to our system, and there's, you know, and they get their power turned back on. I believe that as long as there are people who are in that situation and that predicament, you have some disruption that has an economic cost that's borne by other customers. What we see today is that about 1 in 5 people who are eligible for benefit receive that benefit. I don't believe that moving from, and that was at the $20 million, 15 plus the 5. I don't believe at $20 million we move away from being able to make that argument. I don't know at what point we would not be able to make that argument. I just don't know the answer to that.
Follow up. Right. So when you say eligible, that means unable to pay is what I assume it makes, or is there more to it than that?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, when it comes to eligibility, there must be proof that a shutoff is imminent. And so a notice that you are in arrears is delivered. And then there are also, on top of that, income qualifiers. And I could get you that more specific information.
This is the same conversation literally that we had 5 years ago. And the challenge was just to make sure that we weren't imposing upon the rest of the ratepayers an obligation that someone else should indeed be paying, and that people could simply say, well, I just don't have to pay, so I'm not going to, and then suddenly the rest of ratepayers get to pick it up. That's just not right. And so I'm just wanting you guys to say that my concerns are unwarranted. So are they?
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, they are unwarranted.
And you'll supply me a follow-up.
Yes, sir.
Me with something so indicating.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Helm, Representative Benz, if I may, in addition to the costs which are within the utility system, and if Cub were here, I think they would say that, this is why they support this bill, is because of its ability to keep rates lower. But typically when we see a shutoff, we also see an eviction. And so the social cost to the community, which is outside of the scope of your question, but is also great.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Holby.
Just one pretty basic question. I guess I'm just not remembering or not familiar with. Could you describe what Oregon Community Power is? Oregon Community Power is? What's the entity that's in the statute?
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, I'd like to come and have that be a separate conversation another time if it could. There's some peculiar legislative history that I don't actually recall around Oregon Community Power that I'd have to get some more information to come back on. I could take a stab at it, but I'm sure I'd get it wrong, and that would be unhelpful to everybody, I'm sure.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, unfortunately, I've seen that language in statute and wondered myself and haven't bothered to ask.
Well, they seem to be they seem to be a pretty substantive part of this bill, so I think it'd be good for us to understand a little bit about it.
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, without going too far down this, I believe Oregon Community Power is not something that it's referred to in statute, and I believe that it is a mechanism that can be triggered in certain circumstances, and that Oregon Community Power doesn't function today. It's not an entity today. It's not actual. It's sort of a eventuality that could happen in statute, but I'd have to get some more information and come back on. It's not actually a functioning. It's not like Housing Community Services where it's a department today. It's something that, and I believe it has to do with if there were a purchase effort for an investor-owned utility that a public power entity could be created that would be called Oregon Community Power, but I'd want to get you some more information on that.
Sounds like an obsolete piece of statutory language. Well, thank you.
Any further questions? All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2134. At this time, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2331. I'm going to ask Beth to give us an overview, and then our representative from DAS is here to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2331, you heard on the 22nd of February, there's a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement issued on the measure. 2010, the legislature enacted Senate Bill 1019, which authorized DAS to sell, dispense, and distribute CNG to private entities. This authorization is scheduled to sunset January 2nd, 2018. House Bill 2331 would extend the authorization to continue to allow DAS to sell, dispense, and distribute CNG to private entities until January 2nd, 2025.
Thank you, Beth. Lindsay, go right ahead.
Sure. Good afternoon, Chair Hall, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Baker, and I'm the Government Relations Director at the Department of Administrative Services. As Beth just indicated, this bill was originally before this committee, I believe a couple of weeks ago. It was relatively brief, the public hearing was, and we essentially just said that we've been able to offer for sale compressed natural gas from our facility over on Airport Road. We've been doing this for a number of years, and the idea here was just to sort of close the gap in infrastructure along the I-5 corridor with the hopes that at some point private market would come in and fill the void. To date, the closest facilities are one in Springfield and one in Lakewood, Washington. And so this one here in Salem is the only one in between those two points. And so we would just like to be able to continue to provide those fuel and access to that facility for members of the public until private market comes in. And that's all. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I don't recall the testimony. I expect it was said at the time. What does DAS make or spend net on this portion of your operation?
I'm not sure. I would imagine it's pretty minimal. I apologize. I don't have the numbers before me, but I can definitely provide that information to you at a later date.
Let me ask it a different way. Is the intent to break even? Or to make some money, or what?
Again, I'm not sure specifically. I would assume that we are not subsidizing the cost of the provision, so at the very least, we'd be breaking even. But again, we are providing it to the private market, to members of the public, not just for our fleet.
Right. I understand.
Do you have a further follow-up?
Well, I was just going to suggest that we perhaps may want to wait on the work session until we get the answer to those questions. They're pretty important, I think.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Johnson's here.
So, Lindsay, just to confirm, this is just to maintain what DAS is currently doing, not to expand into other locations.
That's correct.
Right. Any further questions? Representative Johnson.
Well, just thought I haven't really looked at it, but to Representative Barnhart's question, would that not be revealed in our fiscal impact statement?
Do we have one?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair,
can you go?
Mr. Chair and committee members, just for the record, there's a no fiscal impact statement issued on House Bill 2331.
Revenue impact?
It's not really a budget.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there is a no revenue impact statement issued as well.
Any further questions at this time? Representative Bent.
Mr. Chair, in our previous meeting, I think it was pointed out that sadly, the facility is receiving very little use. So I'm also assuming that, in all probability, when we do get the information back, it will be a fairly modest activity. So That's probably why we have the two non-event reviews.
May I add a comment to that, if I could?
Representative Barton.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense to me. I suspect that's true. We were trying to help get an industry developing, and it simply isn't happening. I'd hate to strand somebody in Salem unable to refuel because we closed this thing. That's the other way of looking at it.
I'm going to stand at ease for a couple minutes. Rather on HB 2331 back to order. And Representative Barnhart, did you have an additional question?
No, thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions? Okay, then I'd entertain a motion.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Power moves House Bill 2331 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion?
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Holder.
I would like the answer from DAS. I'm comfortable moving this bill forward, but it would still be nice to get the answer to the Representative Barnhart's question.
Very good. Can the department provide that for us?
Chair Helm, Representative Holby, absolutely, yes.
Very good. Sure. Okay. Yes, Mr.
So if we're going to get the answer to the question, well, let's wait and get the answer rather than move the bill now. I want to be a yes on this bill, but I don't want to be going forward and then finding out later that there was something we didn't know and want to change my vote later on the floor. That would be unfortunate. So I think the better thing to do is get the information and then move forward.
Okay. I think that's a reasonable position. Mm-hmm. So what we'll do is we will carry House Bill 2331 over to a work session on March 8th. And if you can have those answers for us, we'll quickly finish up what we were doing today at that time.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to close the work session. Do I leave the work session?
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to close the work session on 2331 for today. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2268 and invite the department up. Oh, yeah. Welcome. Go right ahead.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the legislative advisor for the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. We are here to take any questions you might have on the -1 amendment to House Bill 2268. I believe that was discussed pretty extensively at the public hearing, but if there are questions for the department, I'm here, and Mike Kordenhoff, who is our regional or our program manager in the Northwest Regional Office, is also available if there are technical questions.
I understand there's a -1 amendment. I don't remember if that was available at our last hearing, but it might be good to refresh our memory.
Oh. Mr. Chair and committee members, just also for the record, there is that -1 amendment. It replaces the measure and then established a certain fee structure for each underground storage tank subject to permit requirements. It was $195 for the calendar year in 2018, $245 for the calendar year 2019, $295 for the calendar year 2020, $325 for the calendar year 2020, and $325 for each subsequent calendar year. There was a no revenue impact statement issued. Fiscal impact statement issued, which is also available on OLIS for the committee and the public, and there is a subsequent referral on this bill to the Committee on Joint Ways and Means.
Are there any questions for panel? Representative Dent.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'm almost embarrassed to say this, but I was actually reading some of the material that Chair Barnhart handed out in our Revenue Committee, and I came across a federal statute, it was actually RC 4081 sub D little 3, which of course is a federal law that requires so much per gallon be paid to clean up underground tanks. So I contacted your office and ask how much money we received each year from that. And my question is, and I got the answer. I have the answer here, in fact. But perhaps you could tell the committee how that money is used, how much it is, and how it's used, and why these numbers apparently supplement that number.
Chair Helm, for the record, my name is Mike Kortenhoff, Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. I'm the manager of the Underground Storage Tank Inspection Program. Chair Helm, or Representative Bentz, the federal EPA funds portions of our program, and they issue two different kinds of grants to us using what we call the Lust Trust Fund, and that's the federal gas tax that you're referring to. And a portion of the base grants that operate our program are coming from the federal revenue, and the fees that DEQ uses supplement the rest of the program and pay for the full inspection program. We can only operate a portion of our program on the federal revenue we get, and it's designed to be a combination of federal and state revenue.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing I would suggest is in the summary that was handed out in support of these fee increases, I didn't see any reference to this particular fee. I may have missed it. But it seemed to me that I would have enjoyed that larger picture of the fact that there are other monies coming from other sources to support this program. The number is not inconsequential, but perhaps it is in light of the risk that goes with these tanks. It was $263,000 from the leak prevention grant and $117,000 from the state and tribal assistance grant. Those are the numbers I got. Does that sound correct?
Yeah.
So in the neighborhood of 500,000.
Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, yes, those are the grant dollar amounts that pay for just the underground storage tank inspection program. And there's additional federal revenue that pays for the cleaning up of underground storage tanks, too.
And if I might, Chair Helm, Representative Bentz, for future reference, and when we put these type of fact sheets together so we can make them a little bit better, you're asking for the total picture of the revenues that go to support a program? Because I think the fact sheet was more directed at what is the amount of the supplemental to maintain our program. But just to be clear, you're asking for an understanding of what revenue sources of a program relies on its entirety. Is that fair?
Sure. What I'm saying is we're asking folks to pay a certain amount per tank, and there had to be some reference to something in coming to that number. And I don't know what that was, because it was a work group. You guys worked it out and reached agreement. But the fact that there are other funds available from outside sources, not our general fund, but other sources, would have been an interest to me had I read this, because it would have shown me that this is an extremely expensive program and we need this additional money from these folks, and we are all getting this federal money too. That would be of interest. I think it does. It all goes to the fact that these are incredibly risky business to have an underground tank. Mm-hmm. And so I understand why people are willing to pay this kind of money, because the other side of it's really bad.
Right.
But it would have helped to have seen that there. Then it wouldn't have been suspicious that you had 40, 50 million coming in from some other source. Yeah.
Understand.
Yeah. Save me some research time. Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, both of you. Real quick, I'm looking back at my notes, and I don't have it written down. Maybe we discussed it before, but when was the last time fees were increased?
Yep. Chair Helm, Representative Reschke, the last time the fees were set by the legislature was 2007, when the $135 fee that we're now requesting to be increased was set.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Brocksmith.
Thank you. So to add to Representative Reschke, as the cost of doing business increased so much that by 2021 it's going to cost almost twice as much as it did in 2007.
So
So, Chair Helm, Representative Rocksmith, I think what the Dash 1 amendment attempts to do is to phase in over time the cost increases that are necessary to maintain our program. And it is the number, $325 per tank is what we were able to work out with that matched our needs and met the goals of the stakeholders to see a gradual increase over time rather than get a more sudden increase and higher increase sooner. There's no question our costs have gone up when you think about the length of time in which the fee increase or the need for the fee increase.
Okay. Very good. At this time, I will ask if there's a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendment.
Chair Helm, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated February 13th, 2017.
Representative Power moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 2013-2017. Is there any discussion? If there's no further discussion, is there any objection? Not, the amendments adopted.
Chair Helm, I move House Bill 2268 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Power moves House Bill 2268 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, many members has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay.
That was the fiscal.
There is a fiscal, isn't there?
Yeah. Okay. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Reinhart?
Aye.
Representative Vent?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Excused.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Reschke?
No.
Representative Rocksmith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Power?
Aye.
Chair Helm?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thanks. At this time, I'm going to open a public hearing on HJM 5. And Representative Holby, I understand you'll be presenting.
Yes, I'll open it up if you don't mind. Mr. Chair, I'll just do it from here because it will be relatively short. And
we have Ken Niles from Oregon Department of Energy to assist.
Right. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This particular joint memorial, though I very rarely do joint memorials, Senator Beyer and I, after reviewing the Department of Energy in an oversight committee for quite some time, looked at one of the programs about nuclear safety and Hanford oversight. And, you know, looking into that issue, became a little bit alarmed at the lack of pace and, I guess, I won't say seriousness that the federal government takes on taking care of Hanford so as to prevent contamination mostly to the Columbia River. And so there was two things that we recognized in Hanford that we felt the federal government should address quicker. One of them is the storage of waste. They've been long working on vitrification, which is putting nuclear waste into a glass log and sealing it up in a stainless steel container for burial someplace safe. Not sure where that is exactly, but anyway, it seemed like the federal government was taking a really long time to transfer waste out of leaking tanks and building new tanks to put them into to prevent further contamination of groundwater, all the time relying on this new process to get concluded, which still seems out in the future. So we thought there was more urgency for them to build new tanks to put the waste into to stop the leaking. And then subsequent to that, they also have a very good system of, and I can't describe it very well, but they basically extract the groundwater out and run it through a series of pumps and can actually clean the water and then recharge the clean water back into the system to address the plumes and to stop these plumes from growing into the Columbia River. They have one successful plant like that, but the problem is they have some larger plumes that are actually more of a danger to the Columbia River, which they're not taking action on in the same way. And so we feel the federal government needs to invest a lot more energy and time, energy, no pun on the energy piece, to clean up this mess, and thought that we should support Oregon's part in overseeing this cleanup to protect Oregon's interest, and that the legislature should, you know, put forward a HGM like HGM 5. However, it does need an amendment, and probably not due to any fault of legislative council, but they probably didn't get clear enough direction on what we wanted in this HGM. So having said that, I'll turn it over to somebody who can talk more articulately about the issue. I can't even say the word. So,
go right ahead.
Chair Helm, members of the committee, my name is Ken Niles. I'm the Assistant Director for Nuclear Safety at the Oregon Department of Energy. Appreciate the opportunity to testify today on House Joint Memorial 5. The Oregon Department of Energy supports this measure, but as Representative Helvey mentioned, has requested an amendment to clarify that the production of plutonium at Hanford created both radioactive and chemical hazardous waste, and that not keeping pace with needed actions creates a variety of different risks for long-term protection of the Columbia River. The Hanford site is an incredibly unique place. We are nearing three decades since the cleanup began. It will be 28 years in May of this year. And the expectations are that the cleanup will continue for another 40 or 50 or 60 years or more. And while much has been accomplished and much has been done to reduce the risk to Oregon and to the Columbia River, plenty more remains to be done. Congress has provided already an incredible amount of money for the cleanup of Hanford, about $40 billion so far. Mm-hmm. And remarkably, it hasn't been enough. There's a great need for additional funding so that important cleanup programs can move forward. In the past decade or so, we have seen considerable progress in dealing with the contaminated groundwater at Hanford. From Oregon's perspective, contaminated groundwater reaching the Columbia River is the most likely way that we could be impacted. In part because of Oregon's insistence, groundwater cleanup has moved considerably forward in recent years. We have seen a number of groundwater plumes reduced in size, and we have seen, in many cases, the groundwater plumes have been stopped from entering the Columbia River. But there are a number of groundwater contamination plumes and different radioactive and chemical materials within the groundwater that have yet to be treated. Expansion of these treatment systems is necessary, and for that to happen in a timely manner, Congress will need to provide additional funding for the cleanup at Hanford. There are so many needs at Hanford. Just last month, we provided comments on a draft interim cleanup plan that laid out $180 million worth of work at one of Hanford's five chemical processing facilities. And that money is just to put that facility in a relatively safe condition for the next several decades until it moves up enough in the priority list to actually be torn down. $180 million just to put it in a safe condition. Over the past 25 years, the Oregon legislature has passed a number of memorials and resolutions related to Hanford cleanup and Hanford funding. In each case, it has clearly signaled Oregon's continuing commitment towards what is one of the most significant environmental challenges facing our state. Thank you for your consideration of this memorial. Please support HJM 5.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that. Not really questions, just comments. And, you know, this is an important issue, and being in a community that, you know, lives alongside the river, I know my constituents are
you know, they support this effort. But I don't know how many of you all have had a chance to actually take a tour of the Hanford plant that's operating up there. But if you haven't, I would sure recommend you do, because it's just an amazing facility. But, I mean, we're talking here about, you know, nuclear power and the creation of it and so forth, and activities that occurred many, many years ago before we knew the implications of what we were playing with. But it's amazing to me that on that property at Hanford now, they have, in a couple of silo-type structures there, every bit of nuclear waste that's been generated there over the last how many years that's been open. And it's a very small little footprint, and it's really safe. And they've got some tremendous just technology going on there. It's a huge base load for the BPA system. I think it's about 12% of BPA's, you know, base that provides power for us. So anyway. Actions long ago continue to haunt us today, but we'll get it fixed and improve public health as we go forward. So, thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Bowlby, did you want to wrap up?
No, I'll just wrap up by saying, as soon as we get this amendment back, we'll get it back to the committee administrator, and hopefully we can take action. I think it's important for us to continue to send a message to the federal government to keep up with this contamination, because it could really destroy a huge piece of our economy and, you know, be very detrimental to our environment if they don't keep up with this.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 5. With that committee, I need to make a clarification about the carryover of House Bill 2331. Our rules require any carryover to be made to the next regular meeting of the committee, which happens officially to be tomorrow night. And so I'll carry over House Bill 2331 to our next regular meeting, which is on 3/7/2017, and tomorrow night I will be carrying the bill over to March 8th. So we will actually be hearing it again. It'll come before this committee here at the regularly scheduled time on Wednesday, March 8th. Representative Brocksmith.
Just a question, Mr. Chair. I thought when you mentioned the meeting for tomorrow that it wasn't mandatory.
It's not.
And
but so it is officially posted, so that we can both use the posting facilities of OLIS and post materials.
How can you do business, though, if you can't have a quorum present?
Yeah.
Well,
that's
good. That is a good question.
Right?
I don't know, maybe somebody else.
Well, I assume the committee's adopted the normal rules, and if it has, then the quorum for a hearing is one member or more, and a quorum for an information meeting is one member or more. It's only a work session that requires a regular quorum.
Okay. Thanks for that.
Have I understood that correctly?
Yeah.
I have. Okay.
All the same.
To clarify, I'm going to let Beth clarify, because I'm new to these rules, and we tried to put this rather unique committee together.
So, Mr. Chair and committee members, just to clarify, so the committee tomorrow is posted, and you are all able to attend if you should so want to. That would not be a violation. This is a posted meeting. I think Representative Helm was just clarifying that it's your attendance is optional. So he will be able to carry over at the meeting tomorrow.
And with that, I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Energy and Environment. I'm allowed. Energy and Environment. I'm allowed. House Committee on